Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Welcome to From Idea to Impact. I'm Sampriti Ganguly, Arabella's CEO, and I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Charisse Conan and Johnson. Charisse is a managing partner at Next Street, where she heads up the advisory practice, and she's also the author of Wealthy Girl, Seven Steps to Peace, Prosperity, and Personal Power. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. Welcome, Charisse. We're so excited to have you here at our podcast today.
I am super pumped to be here this morning. It is sunny outside, and so I'm going to take some of that ray of sunshine and bring it into this conversation.
That is wonderful, and I'm really excited to be here in conversation with you today. And before we sort of talk a little bit about sort of our work, our mission, and impact, I'd love to know a little bit more about you, and in particular, your origin story. How is it that we find you here at this particular moment?
Love that question, because one, I don't think many people start there. And so, thank you for the opportunity to just share a little bit about my origin story and where I'm from and how that leads to where we are today. And so, first of all, you should know about me. I'm from Strong Island. Other people might know that as Long Island, outside of New York City. And I am the child of a teacher as well as a nurse. And so growing up there, I grew up all there 18 years of my life, and they really enforced in me a belief of pursuing a life of purpose. Their professions, they care for other people and want the best for other people. And so I took that with me when I went to Yale University, and I thought I was going to be a doctor. And quickly, I love math, I love science. That wasn't the issue. For me, it was much more about there's other ways to help people. And so I got introduced to economics. I got introduced to the field of American studies, which if you're not familiar, it's all about a critique on American history through the eyes of race, gender, and class. And so when you combine that with economics and being at Yale, I'm from a blue collar, also, you know, working class town in Long Island. And so when I got there, I just had an overwhelming experience in being surrounded by lots of rich people, lots of wealthy people. And those are different, actually. But ultimately, I wanted to learn how to go and pursue wealth. And that led me to a career on Wall Street at JP Morgan after college. And wealth became sort of a personal mantra for me. I learned how to invest in the stock market. And while I was there, however, I realized, you know what? Stocks aren't the only way to generate wealth. There are lots of different asset classes, private equity, venture capital, as well as real estate, bonds. And I was drawn to the venture capital side of the house and private equity side of the house and the world of entrepreneurship. Before companies become public and that we invested in, they were small companies that become bigger. And so that really made an impression upon me. And I decided to leave JP Morgan. I had a different calling on my life to go pursue that entrepreneurial journey. And I left, moved to Chicago for business school. And for me, it was much more about, you know, de-risking that transition. I went to business school to help with that and tried to move into the world of entrepreneurship. And I then started a financial technology company, ran that for a couple of years. And ultimately though, some of the challenges that I faced as a woman of color, as a Black woman specifically, and raising capital, we ended up closing that company. And that was instrumental to me. We had a lot of other successes in terms of employing people and creating something out of nothing, but ultimately it left a taste in my mouth. And as I looked at sort of combining what it means to be wealthy across different dimensions, I decided to find another place, and this place became Next Street. I did some independent consulting and some teaching in between, but ultimately Next Street was at that intersection of small business, entrepreneurship, wealth creation, and it was still small enough that it had that feel and that mindset around, let's do something special together. So here I am.
That's a phenomenal journey. And in many ways, I think consistent with a lot of the experiences I've had. I'm originally from India. I'm a little bit of an outsider to the system here in the United States. And it's been hard, but also an opportunity to be a woman in sort of predominantly male-dominated spaces and fields for me in the professional services sector. Tell me a little bit more about Next Street and the work that you all do at the intersection of sort of entrepreneurship, small businesses, and unlocking new sources of capital.
Absolutely. So first, you should know that Next Street's been around for 15 years. It was started by Tim Ferguson, who's our founder, and now serves on the chairman of the board. And he had a vision that quality advice could be provided to small businesses. And because he was coming from Britain, he had also the view of a merchant banking system, where if you combine quality advice with capital and provide that to small businesses, they could grow and they could scale. And so that was the genesis of Next Street and wanting to provide that advice with consulting services to particularly small businesses and underserved communities. When Next Street started, that meant urban. It also meant businesses owned by people of color. It meant women. And so with that as our founding story, over the future years, and you know, when Next Street was started in 2005, I joined in 2015, and we've evolved as a company. Today, we no longer provide direct consulting advice to small businesses, but we're organized with one mission, and that is to create a more inclusive environment for small businesses. And we do that by working with large institutions, whether it be foundations, corporations, governments, all in service of mobilizing how capital and how customers and how capabilities get to these small businesses and entrepreneurs, and particularly those that have been systemically held back. And so that founding narrative around that systemic held back still holds true today. We are an anti-racism organization, or I should say anti-racist organization. And so anti-racism is at the center of what we do. And we do so by still consulting, but consulting to those larger institutions. We do some direct service to small businesses, but they're not the payer of those services. They are the recipient and beneficiary, because our client, which might be like a city or government, pays us to work with small businesses. And we do that by helping to enable capital to flow from large traditional institutions to some of the alternative, what we call community development financial institutions, or CDFIs.
So Charisse, you shared with us earlier why you decided to go get an MBA. And I'm sure in your work, you find and uncover a lot of these systemic barriers that small businesses and small entrepreneurs have to capital, even within the systems that are designed to support them, like the Small Business Administration or other agencies. I'm curious, as you are exploring and delving deeper into your anti-racist policies, what are some of the bigger, bolder ideas that are inspiring to you? What are some of the system level changes that you believe are necessary to help really unlock and transform capital to underserved communities?
Great question. And so I think in order for me to answer that too, I want to share a few stats that tie to those bold ideas, particularly in this current environment. Obviously, racism at the forefront of this country and at the globe, quite honestly. And so a couple of stats. Today, less than 1% of venture capital funding goes to Black founders. Today, business owners of color experience, when it comes to debt capital or loans, 2 times the loan denial rates of their white-owned business counterparts. And when they do get capital, they get it at higher interest rates, all things else being equal. And then when they do get capital, they receive less of it than their white counterparts. And again, I'm talking mainly about the racial piece of the entrepreneurs who are systemically held back. But I think when you have stats like that, it's important then to think about what it is that, to your point, can help shift the conditions that are holding these problems in place or systemic change. And a couple of ideas that we have, and I think that we need to have as a country, part of the systemic issues lie in the infrastructure that has been created in this country. And part of that starts with the Small Business Administration. And I know, obviously, with the new presidency, we're not going to change all of that at once. But even the plan that was released even this past Monday on changes to one of the major sources of capital, which is the Paycheck Protection Program, was, you know, inspiring. So unless we have strong changes at the federal policy level that change how credit, for instance, is afforded to small businesses and the requirements that disadvantage people of color systemically because it relies on credit score, because it relies on collateral. And in America, there have been institutional policies that have been predominantly targeted to prevent, you know, people of color from attaining some of those things historically. And we're not going to write those overnight, but it starts with large systemic federal policy. I think the other thing, you know, and so you asked too, like, what can we do in real time? Right now, we're seeing the proliferation of lots of, for instance, more equity funds out in the market. Every day, you're probably reading about, you know, $100 million here, $200 million here. Just last week, JP Morgan, for instance, announced their $200 million commitment in working with Ariel to support and invest equity capital into businesses that are poised for scale. And why don't we get business owners of color leading those businesses and have that succession transfer such that wealth can be created? And I would leave you with one last bold idea, which is, I think, the role of philanthropy. I think we fundamentally need to change our approach to how dollars are allocated to small businesses and how they are allocated to the intermediaries that then support them, whether it's service provision or capital directly. And one of the biggest challenges that business owners of color have is that they don't have the family and friends capital to even get started. And again, that ties back to the lack of generational wealth and the gap in wealth because of the same policies that have prevented these people from gaining wealth, you know, dominate this field. And so if we ask philanthropy, how are you spending the dollars that are sitting in your endowment, that are sitting, you know, in, you know, large troves? And also, what are you requiring of these service organizations to help in a way that takes off, I think, some of the handcuffs that sometimes tie, you know, one's ability, but also at the systems level, organizations' ability to help, albeit capital or on service provision.
Yeah, it's a fascinating kind of construct, Charisse. And we've been talking a lot in the philanthropy sector. I think I saw a statistic that said something like it would cost about $10 trillion to make up for the racial equity gap that has been built over generations. Mm-hmm. How do you think about some total of philanthropic assets to help to address that, to repair, to harm, to recognize? Mm-hmm. And I think, to your point, we need to be out in the field with those bolder ideas to aspire to think bigger. Let me ask you a different in kind question, which is, you have been in, for all intents and purposes, a capitalist system for in your career, and many in the philanthropic field, particularly those that come from a social justice background, have calls to sort of transform that system entirely, yeah, the system of capitalism. You have recently written a book, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about sort of Wealthy Girl, Seven Steps to Peace, Prosperity, and Personal Power. And I'm curious, how do you reconcile or acclimate people to this construct of, this is a system that at its core is built on denying power and denying opportunity and access to capital for a large swath of our society, and yet it is the economic system that empowers and drives us? And I'm curious, how do you kind of think about that? And based off of that, what tips do you have for building wealth for women?
Love that question. it's a big one and it's layered, right? And so I'll try to tackle it in a few different ways, but also hopefully you'll get the build upon for each of the different pieces here. First of all, I totally recognize, and I think we need people like you and I in this field where we sit at that intersection of purpose, right, and profit, in order to agitate, in order to try and dismantle the way in which power has been misused to perpetuate some of the racism and some of the bad of capitalism. And for all intents and purposes, I think capitalism is a good thing when it's used for the right purposes. And so I think we have to stop having conversation and not, you know, out there in the world around, let's put these people in one box over here in the nonprofit space. Let's put these people in a box over here in the business space. How can we work together? If the goal is justice, if the goal is impact and the greater good, and I think obviously the last year has pressed upon this very issue in a real way, and CEOs questioning and demanding, how can we do both, be good and do well? And I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. And so the reality is, my answer is, I have to hold both. I have to be able to exist in the system as it currently exists, with the eye towards changing the very system that I'm working in for the betterment of the good. And I have to be able to hack the system. I have to be able to have and subvert the system and have alternative ways than the traditional system to do stuff. And so you have to do both, because it's going to take some time for the big system change that we want. And in the meanwhile, I'm not going to sit on my hands. I still have to also do things that subvert the very system that I'm trying to change. And I think, that's exactly why I wrote the book, A Wealthy Girl, 7 Steps to Prosperity, Peace, and Personal Power, because of those tensions. And I would even argue opportunities. And so one of the myths that I talk about in the book is there's only a select group of wealthy white people. I fundamentally believe that that is not true. And I think if we start to redefine what wealth is, traditionally wealth is based on your net worth, which is your total financial assets, minus your total debt. And those financial assets can include stocks, it could include bonds, your business, real estate, minus your debt, which is, mortgage debt, credit card debt, whatever it is. And I don't think that is adequate enough to measure wealth for you as an individual, for me as an individual, particularly people of color and particularly women, because why should we chase a standard that never had us in mind in the first place and that systemically has prevented us from attaining what it is that standard aspires to hold true? So that's a fundamental core of the book, but also what I believe to be held true. And so when I think about tips to, even hack the system, I draw on inspiration from our ancestors. One of the books that was fundamental, I think, in providing a historical account of Black banks and the racial wealth gap is Mercia Baradaran's book. In that book, we learned about the history of mutual aid societies, which were a collection, of ways for, Black individuals to find ways to support businesses. For instance, provide capital to those businesses outside traditional banking systems. Why? Because those banking systems did not support them or did not, provide them capital. We can take that concept. What are ways that which we can have systems that are not traditional? I call those wealth circles. In immigrant communities, they might be SUSUs. In, historically, Black communities, again, they were mutual aid societies, but alternative forms of financing that don't rely on the same system that has tried to push you out. In my own family, we have a wealth circle of about 8 family members, and we raise money together, we invest together, and we have to not be reliant on the same system that, again, we're trying to change. So that's one concrete example, but there are others like that, because it's going to take the power of the collective in order to do that. And obviously you've been also hearing about, you know, the Buy Black movement around buying from businesses. If we don't support each other, and we is not just Black people, we is white people, we is, you know, everything in between, in order to give these businesses revenue, which is the best form of financing, doesn't rely on debt capital, doesn't rely on equity capital. It relies on people demanding and wanting a product or service.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal perspective. You know, I'll share a personal story. I'm originally from India. My maternal grandmother had an arranged marriage at the age of 15. My mm-hmm. paternal grandmother had an arranged marriage at the age of 12. And not only did they not get to choose their partner in life, their economic fortunes were entirely a function of the sort of partner that was chosen for them. And I remember at a very early age, them instilling in me what they saw as an opportunity for not just personal fulfillment and being able to choose a life partner, but also financial fulfillment and independence. And so in many ways, to your point around ancestors, I take that with me very deeply as I think about financial independence. And I always counsel women who are often debating whether they stay home to raise children versus remain in the workplace in that mm-hmm. stage of life where there's, you know, real tensions in those, to say, think about your wealth, if you have a partner, as sort of the cumulative family assets, not what is a woman's earning and what is a man's earning and how do those two play together. And I encourage them to very early on take ownership, accountability, and responsibility for their personal wealth. And it's an uncomfortable conversation, I think, still to this day around women and financial independence. And so I'm inspired by what you've written. I thank you for bringing this out into the community. I know you've got some upcoming webinars, so I would encourage those who are listening to us to participate. I guess in closing, I'd ask you one question. As near as I can tell, you wrote a book in the midst of a pandemic while being a leader in a growing for-profit business, and you had a baby at that same time. And so I think that is like the definition of superwoman or superpowers. I am curious, it takes a skilled multitasker to be able to do that. Any tips that you have around your strategies for multitasking that you'd want to share with the listeners today?
Absolutely. So it's interesting because a year ago at this time, I was being connected to my now publisher. Literally, I look back at the email and it was February the 25th of 2020. So good timing for this opportunity, right? And a month later, we started working together to write this book. And I tell you, but for COVID, this book would not be written. But for the amazing, you talked about partnership and collective assets. I totally believe in that wholeheartedly. And that extends beyond, you know, the financial for me. It extends how are the partners in your life and however you define that, whether it's, you know, romantic partner or friendship partner or your larger community, supporting you and supporting me in my effort. So I made it a goal of mine to finish the book, even with my daughter, who at the time was about 10 months when I started on this journey. And it was amazing to see the outpouring of support from my husband. And obviously, I mean, I'm still married to him, so I mean, I love him deeply. And, you know, like, marriage is a daily act of love. And, but, you know, to see how he has stepped up to pursue my goal, but also that's our goal. If we do this well and we're doing it well because we're defining success of what that means for us and our family, then we are going to work together toward that. So, you know, if it was him making sure that our daughter, you know, gets to daycare and her doctor's appointments, which a lot of times, at least on the appointment side, fall on the mom, you know, he stepped up in a mighty way. And the community of support also from my parents and my sibling and, you know, friends. So it takes a village. One of the things that I believe wholeheartedly is in the power of the collective and asking for support. I mean, as women, and I'm sure you might be challenged, maybe it's just me, I can be a control freak. I can take, you know, ownership of things and how I want them and to be done, but I have to let go of some of that. They might not do it how I would do it, but it's going to get done. And so being able to delegate, being able to be comfortable in not having my hand in everything, which is, you know, part of growth, right? And I outsource a lot. I mean, I outsource my cleaning. I outsource, you know, sometimes our cooking, and being comfortable with making those trade-offs, which, you know, obviously they come with financial, and I call them investments. I don't call them costs, because that allows me more time to spend with my daughter and me more time to spend with our family. And those are real trade-offs. My time is my most valuable asset. And so I also have gotten good at saying no. I am not available all the time, 24/7. I am not going to respond to emails often, you know, within hours. I had to change and reframe what's important to me and what are the couple of things that I need to focus on with the business, with my family, and ultimately, Sampriti, my faith. My faith played a huge role in being able to hope for something that I could not see yet. I could not see the outcome of this book. I could not see where we will have, where we evolved as a company. But I held on to that faith that I was going to see a positive outcome. And that for me is centering. I have an affirmation every day and it goes like this. Lord, let my light shine today. Let my words and my actions be Christ-like and fulfill the purpose that you have for my life. Close the doors that need to be closed. Open the doors that need to be open. Protect my family so that I may see them again. And that really has helped me to integrate and also take the rest that I need. Because one thing about particularly Black women and women of color, I would argue in general, is that we do take on the superwoman, you know, label, but also try to do that. But we are exhausted and we need to take time for ourselves, and we deserve to. We need to invest in that self-care, and I believe in that wholeheartedly.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Charisse, and thank you for opening the door to us to have a little bit of a window into both your book, but who you are. And please accept my deepest gratitude for joining us today. And I look forward to hearing more from you in future podcasts.
Thank you so much, Sampriti. This was so much fun, and I look forward to talking more soon.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.